listening to KRFY 88.5. I am Mark Warren. I am joined in the studio with Will Love and the Sandpoint Reader editor-in-chief, Zach Hagedon. This is North Idaho News of the Week. Will, Zach, how are you guys doing?
Terrific. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing wonderful. I think we're going to kick off today's show by doing a fire update. The BTOP fire, which is the one that we have been talking about the most recently, is now been put on patrol status, meaning the crews will check on the fire regularly, but will not need to build any additional containment lines. It is seemingly pretty contained. However, the Consolas fire, which is out in Pend'Oreille County, Washington, has burned over 444 acres at this point and is only 10% contained. This fire season is looking like it could be bad. From an article out of the Idaho Capital Sun, Clark Corbin said that due to the conditions in North Idaho and due to the drought conditions in North Idaho and warmer than normal temperatures, most North Idaho and Southwest Idaho has an elevated risk of wildfires through September. Obviously, this is not a new issue for us. We've been dealing with this for years, but it's seeming like this year could be worse than most.
I would say, though, I am a little bit surprised that we haven't had those layers of smoke so far. You know, we're almost into August, so it's been a little bit different than the last couple of years.
I guess our wind patterns have been favoring us, because I've only noticed maybe 2 or 3 days where it was even kind of noticeable.
Yeah, no, most of the time it has been pretty unnoticeable. If anything, you know, when you go out on the lake, you can see it by the mountains, but I've not smelled any smoke this year, which is a notable difference from...
Well, the nice thing for us is that we don't have air conditioning, so we can have the windows open.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Perfect.
The second story I want to talk about today is Dover is turning 100 years old. Zach, you wrote a story on this. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So Dover is celebrating its centennial, although its history is a little bit more complicated than that. You know, looking back at sort of like where Dover originated, you really can go back all the way to the early 1900s, like the turn of the century, where it was called by a different name. Hello.
You know, I was not trained on how to...
Caller number one. You're not on the air.
Yeah, right. I was told to not pick up any callers.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, okay. So, Dover began life as a little town called Welty, named after the president of the Dover Lumber Company. And it sort of went through some iterations and required a little bit of tragedy even to become the community that it is today. And that took the form of the lumber mill owned by A.C. White and Laclede burning down. And so, you know, this is obviously a huge economic disaster, but they turned it to their advantage, and A.C. White decided to take kind of the radical step of literally floating the town of Laclede up the river to the current site where Dover is today. And that kind of dramatic incident, I think, is where they're really kind of centering their centennial, is the date in, you know, 1922 to 23, where more than 50 houses and other assorted buildings that were used for the mill were put on these big barges and just hauled up the river and then rebuilt. And a lot of them are still there today. I think of the 50 or so original buildings, there's about 30 that still stand in Dover, although pretty radically altered over the century. But so they're kind of taking that as their big celebratory moment. They're going to do a boat parade sort of in honor of that historic float. They've got a community barbecue. There can be some events around the church, which is, you know, one of the sort of central pillar buildings of the town. It used to be A.C. White's summer home, but turned into the church. And I believe his brother was the pastor there for a long time. So they're very excited about doing this event in Dover. And obviously Dover's changed quite a bit, even in the past 20 plus years, mm-hmm. with the Dover Bay development. And, you know, in speaking with the folks out there, they said, yeah, I mean, there's no denying that there's a little bit of a divide between old Dover, quote unquote, or historic Dover and the development. So the event here is meant to sort of bring all the different sides of Dover together and celebrate, you know, this really dramatic 100 years of this little town that is getting bigger and bigger. It was one of the fastest growing towns in all of Idaho.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Last year.
It's the sixth
biggest. Sixth, yeah. And yeah. It's actually only a little bit behind Pend'Oreille in total population now, which...
Yeah, that really shocked me when I read your mm-hmm. article, just seeing that it's over 1,000, more than 1,000 people
yeah.
now.
No, it's crazy. I mean, my mom's lived out there for 20 plus years, and so mm-hmm. I'm fairly familiar with Dover, and I remember it being a very sleepy little place, and so it's kind of weird for me to think that it's the sixth fastest growing mm-hmm. community in the state.
Well, you know, when you go out there, you constantly see these, like, you know, construction buildings, especially in Dover Bay. They're just, like, building houses super fast out there.
Well, one of the things I've always been fascinated about is Sandpoint, and then, you know, the outskirts of Sandpoint, that we've got Dover, and we've got Kootenai and mm-hmm. Monterey, and so, it, you know, it's just... We've got this small town, but it's also got the suburbs.
Kind of. Right. Yeah. And they all have distinct flavors, too, which I think is really cool. I've always appreciated that. I mean, yeah. You get to some of these sort of bedroom communities and they can feel like an extension of the larger town. But I feel like Dover and Ponderay and Kootenai and Laclede all have distinct identities. And I think that's something that is definitely worth celebrating.
Yeah. Just a quick, not a full discussion point, but the Supreme Court has set a date to hear arguments on the open primaries case. That will be Monday, August 7th at 9 a.m.
Right.
That is not something I'm very well versed on, but that is a piece of news that we've been talking about recently.
And that'll be an interesting fight to watch mm-hmm. play out.
The next story I want to talk about was one that, Will, you want to talk about, which was the Beyond Go On Rates, a story from Idaho Ed News. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Idaho Ed News, I think it's summertime, so they're trying to do some evergreen type stories and or series. And so this one has to do with the Go On project that has been taking place in Idaho, just essentially trying to get graduates to think about higher education. And, you know, ultimately, you know, a lot goes into this story, but less than half of students that graduate from high school end up going to higher education right after high school. It doesn't mean that there's some kids that take gap years and stuff like that. But, you know, I just thought it was kind of interesting there as an educator that, mm-hmm. you know, for a long time, there was a big push that, hey, you need to have a plan for after college. And, you know, not that that push isn't still there. We still see it in the high school, but you know, on the other hand, I think that idea of kids just saying like, "I am not going to do this," for a number of factors, is just becoming, I think, a little bit bigger. You know, I was thinking about you two, and just kind of, I mean, it was probably never a doubt that you were going to go on to college. Is that right, Zach?
No, I was always intending, yeah. As quick as I could.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what about you, Mark?
Yeah, no, it was the same for me. I kind of always planned that I was going to go to college. But I graduated in 2021, and I know a lot of people that I graduated with didn't end up going to college, you know, for various reasons. But I think a big point is how expensive it can be these days. It is not a cheap option for a lot of people, and especially up in North Idaho, where there is a good deal of poverty. A lot of people just don't have that option anymore.
Well, I'm 43, almost 43, and I am mm-hmm. still paying student loans. So yeah. There's that. Although I went to a private liberal arts school outside of Boise, so it was a little bit different. But
yeah, you know, some of the comments that they had on kind of seniors in public education were kind of interesting, and you know, it kind of got me thinking about this. One of the quotes was, "My parents and the internet have made me who I am and taught me what I know." And so, you know, just kind of thinking about the idea of self-education and people just saying, "Okay, I'm going to teach myself what I need to know," and kind of bypassing, not necessarily, well, in some cases, public school, and then also in, you know, looking at colleges and stuff like that. So I thought that was kind of an interesting point and probably fits into some demographics here in Idaho that we're just going to teach ourselves how to do this.
Yeah. Well, and I'm trying to remember back to when the Go On initiative started, and I feel like that had to be at least 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we've been talking about this issue for a long time in the state, and mm-hmm. it's interesting to hear that it is not actually improving despite right. all that attention and all the, I remember the marketing campaigns down in the Boise area, the big billboards, and you know, there was commercials on TV and stuff on the radio. And I mean, it was a very high profile campaign. The Go On slogan was everywhere, but yep. I mean, we're not making any headway.
Right. In a sense, I think, you know, one of my takeaways was that this has been kind of a, I guess you would call it a failure.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to put a fine point on it, I mean, it sure sounds like it. Yeah. If we're still, you know, 50%, that's not where we want it to be.
Less than 50%.
Yeah, less than 50%.
I think the target that they wanted was 60%.
I seem to remember that, yes. Yeah. Yep. And that was Governor Otter, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think an interesting point here for North Idaho is, I don't know if you guys mentioned it last week, I wasn't able to listen to the full show, but NIC is going to be continue to be accredited for now, which is a great thing for students in North Idaho, you know, as that is kind of a cheaper option than you know, most universities, and gives students here a way to move past high school and, you know, try to continue to grow their economic and education.
Well, the last thing you want when you're a student is uncertainty about whether or not your institution is even going to be accredited and your diploma worth anything.
Definitely.
The next thing on our docket was the Bonner County Commissioners shutting down public comments and the ordinance for the city council. Zach, I know you had some information on that.
Yeah, we've followed both of these stories for quite a while. And obviously the discussion surrounding public comment at the commissioners' business meetings has been a topic for months. And as, you know, Chairman Bradshaw likes to you know, say, there's nothing in Idaho statute that requires them to offer public comment during a business meeting. Mm-hmm. So it's framed quite often as kind of a courtesy to the public. And some of the rhetoric and some of the behaviors that have surrounded some of those business meetings in recent months have really become rather extreme from, you know, anyone who's watched these meetings will tell you. And really, I think that started around the COVID pandemic. You really started to see the tenor of these public conversations change dramatically. That happened at the county, but it also happened at the city level. And I think the city, watching the tenor of the discourse that's happened at the commissioner meetings, has sort of taken the step to get ahead of it in a way, mm-hmm. with this ordinance that was recently approved. I think it was July 5th. It's an ordinance that had been in the works for more than a year, you know, according to what they said when they first introduced it. They had started working on it before COVID. The pandemic sort of ground everything to a halt, and then they picked it up again just recently. And what the city's ordinance does is that it defines, you know, civility and decorum in the meetings and with interactions with city staff at City Hall or anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. And it sort of puts some teeth to longstanding policies centered on exactly these two issues of civility and decorum. I mean, mm-hmm. you go to a city council meeting and they have the, you know, sort of the public forum portion of the meeting, and then they have hearings and whatnot. But before any sort of public comment occurs in those meetings, the mayor will, you know, kind of reel out his spiel about don't approach the dais, don't direct questions at individual members of the council, don't attack people, don't accuse people of things, don't, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all in this ordinance. Like, so there's nothing new there. Mm-hmm. What is new is that it puts in place an enforcement process for trespassing people from the premises if mm-hmm. they, you know, won't cool their heels or calm down. I mean, if they're getting aggressive and, you know, harassing and abusive, now there's a way for city staff and for the council to say, you know, this person doesn't need to be here right now. Mm-hmm. They're disrupting the meeting. You know, city employees have a right, just like anybody else, to work in a place where they're not feeling, you know, put upon or harassed or threatened. So I think what you're seeing is both the county and the city trying to grapple with this trend of really overheated rhetoric mm-hmm. that pops up in these public spaces. Now, the county, how successfully they do that is, you know, a little iffy. If you watch some of these meetings, I think that the city's ordinance is a more measured approach, perhaps.
I think an interesting thing happening with the commissioner is Asia Williams, I believe, is arriving at the administration building about an hour before to have informal discussions
right.
with the residents,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is interesting. She said, if you don't want to hear the people talk, that's fine, you know, addressing the other two commissioners.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt in anyone's mind the value of public participation in these meetings. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think anyone's saying that, you know, people shouldn't be heard. It's the way that they're expressing themselves, perhaps, that's a little problematic. But then again, you know, you run into issues of, you know, free speech and, mm-hmm. you know, people have a right to be angry, I suppose, right? So then you thread a lot of needles with this kind of thing. And I think that there's been some pushback to the ordinance at the city, even by people who, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see in these meetings as being particularly disruptive. Mm-hmm. They're wary of what they might describe as sort of the subjective nature of some of the definitions here, specifically related to like repeated communications. That's one of the items in the ordinance, is that you can be sort of told to back off if you're found to be, you know, repeatedly communicating with the city on things that they've already answered, mm-hmm. And that your questions become a form of harassment. Now, it's sort of like the Supreme Court ruling on, you know, pornography, right? Like, mm-hmm. I know it when I see it. So there is probably a reality that you could be like, this person is harassing me with these questions, but there is a subjective band in there. You know, mm-hmm. at what point does, you know, filing public records requests become harassing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mayor Ronstadt even mentioned public records requests being, quote, weaponized as one of the reasons for this ordinance. And that, again, is that's a hard row to hoe, I think, maybe.
Yeah. I think something that I want to make sure we can give plenty of time to is the West Bonner updates in the West Bonner story. I'm going to read this out of Idaho Ed News from their article, West Bonner slow rolling Durst emergency certificate. The state hasn't decided whether Superintendent Brandon Durst can officially lead West Bonner because the district hasn't asked. 21 days after the divisive West Bonner school board meeting ended with the hiring of Superintendent Durst, the district hasn't applied for his emergency credits to be fully qualified. He's missing one requirement, 4 years of full-time certified employment in a school. This is interesting that they have not even applied for this yet, as you know, he doesn't have the proper qualifications for it. There's also some issues going on with negotiating with the teachers union and not getting out contracts. Will, can you talk a little bit about that?
Part of that union, so mm-hmm. I don't know exactly where they're at, but you know, I think typically after the fiscal year starts, you usually want to have your contracts in place. I know mm-hmm. that the Lake Monterey School District, passed their budget last month in June, when most school districts will do mm-hmm. that. So, you know, I think it's definitely interesting based on the reporting that's going on, especially I would say a divide between, I think, what I hear that the teachers are asking for, allegedly or reportedly, and what at least one of the board members is thinking that they deserve. And so, you know, you know, ultimately, it comes down to timing too. We've got I think 5 weeks till the school year starts. I'm not exactly sure when the West Bonner County School District what day they officially start. But on the other hand, just on my experience, you know, teachers report a week before Labor Day, and mm-hmm. so that's, you know, 4 days there, and so it'll be interesting to see if they're able to come to an agreement before that time. And then, you know, you don't typically see teacher strikes, especially in Idaho. So, you know, what is, you know, if it comes to an impasse, what's the teachers union willing to do there?
Right.
Yeah.
It's been generally hard to get a clear picture of what's happening in West Bonner overall. And I think that's probably indicative of a little bit of the chaos, you know, if I can use that word, that has surrounded a lot of this. And I think that, speaking of public records requests, that's one of the only tools that people have, you know, to sort of cut through the noise and find out what's really going on. And West Bonner has been sort of notoriously bad at responding to those requests in a timely and lawful manner. Mm-hmm. I mean, Idaho Ed News has reported on this. We've reported on this. Idaho Ed News and The Reader both have active public records pending at West Bonner that haven't been fulfilled, or if they have been fulfilled, they've been fulfilled in what appear to be sort of bizarre ways. I think I mentioned last time I was here that I requested some emails, and it took almost a month to get that request back. And then when I did get it back, it was 177 pages of emails, 144 of which I have spent the past week plus analyzing, and still can find no indication for why those emails were included in the response to my request. They're not connected in any way that I can see to the substance of my request. Mm-hmm. And when asked for, you know, clarification, I still have received none. So,
yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, something that we did talk about last time you were on was a lack of transparency. Something that has been developing over the past day or so is a weird thing happening with the central office staff on their website, where some places on the website it says there are temporary people in that position, and some places it says the previous people are in that position. You know, there is no official word on what's happening there, but that is definitely something to keep an eye out. Something that to me that I don't think has necessarily been talked about enough is the impact of this on the students of West Bonner.
Right.
This kind of thing can really impact them and their education. And they do not get a say in any of the things that is happening. And, you know, I think understanding the impact that they will face because of all this is very important.
Right. And, you know, I think that frustration comes through pretty loud and clear with a lot of the parents, mm-hmm. You know, who may be sort of speaking on behalf of their children. You know, I've heard from just dozens and dozens of residents and, you know, patrons in West Bonner, either by phone or by email, and, you know, looking at social media feeds. And I think there's a lot of frustration out there. And heading into this recall election on August 29th, which is, you know, somewhat unprecedented as well, that just, I think, tells you everything you need to know about, you know, the level of frustration and outright anger, I think, that a lot of people have in that part of the county. And a lot of it has to do with just how hard it is to keep track of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why are certain things transpiring the way they are? Where do these employees go? Why is no one talking? And I did hear, however, that the district will have some open houses coming up. I think Brandon Durst is going to host a couple of town halls. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's an opportunity to get some, you know, some clarity direct from the source.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be very welcome for everyone.
Yeah, I think so, too. I'm reading through this Idaho Ed News article. Durst can continue to serve as the district's leader under another title, such as director, without the professional certificate to be superintendent. So if he doesn't get that certificate, it does not mean he will not be superintendent. It just means he will still be leading the district, just, you know, probably under a different title.
Right.
So one thing that you brought up before we started the show is that essentially he's... not talking to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So Brandon Durst, in response to some records requests, back and forth, became unhappy with the paper, on one of our stories because we failed. It was an error of omission rather than, you know, it was no willful obfuscation on our part, but we just forgot to list one of his credentials. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an executive leadership certificate from Boise State, I believe it is. So we corrected that online and in the paper and apologized to him. But he decided that he was not going to speak to us anymore and told us as much. So I don't know that I'm expecting to hear a whole lot from him going forward. But, you know, that's kind of where he's at with talking to us anyway.
Have you heard any more on the decision, on their potential decision to seek a levy?
That I have not heard. Early on, I heard rumblings about that, but could get it confirmed nowhere. And I think the situation's probably so unsettled that, I mean, I'm just speculating here, but in a climate like that, I don't know that anyone would even have the bandwidth to try to run that. I mean, we don't even really know who's still working in the office.
Yeah, definitely. And what I saw, and I think Idaho Ed News reported, was that essentially, you know, the next time that a district could call for a levy election is in August, which
yep.
would be almost impossible to put together
yeah.
From the business end and, you know, mm-hmm. And with the voting.
I mean, again, speculating here, but my sense after the election when the levy failed, at that time, this was predating all of the stuff that's happened ever since, you know, with the superintendent and all that. I think they were intending, that was my sense, was that they were intending to try to run it again in August, but I just feel like all this has just gotten in the way. And I can't, like you said, I mean, it'd be almost impossible to pull that together in the next couple of weeks, you know?
Yeah.
Well, especially pulling it together with this upcoming recall election.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you could be voting for a levy and a recall.
And a recall, yeah. And yeah. It's conceivable that they could just dust off the old one without much, you know, alteration and then try to run that again. But I haven't had that confirmed anywhere, and I just don't know.
From your experience, I mean, what have you seen a situation like this before?
No, I don't know that anyone has. I know for a fact that the Idaho Ed News people are just like they don't know what's going on, and they're just shocked that there's this level of dysfunction and acrimony in a district, and just, you know, the critical functions are being sort of thrown into disarray, and there's so much uncertainty. And yeah, I think it is a very unique situation. You know, some people try to compare it to what was going on at NIC. I don't know if that's an accurate comparison or not.
Yeah, it seems like they're two very different situations.
But you look at turmoil, you know, in an educational institution, and I'm afraid we might see more of this, you know, in various forms and for various reasons going forward, but let's hope not.
Yeah. I mean, I know that Idaho Ed News's mission is to cover education, but do you think that they are kind of spending a lot more? Because, you know, basically they've got a reporter dedicated to this.
And yeah.
You know, writing 3 or 4 stories a week. I mean, so obviously you think this might be something that is not isolated. It might be something that we see in other districts throughout the state.
I think there's a sense among a lot of the media folks that I know around the state that, you know, they're looking at this very, well, they're very wary of it because they see this as a potential for, you know, other districts to go the same route where, you know, the leadership changes dramatically and there's a lack of transparency about, you know, the decisions that are being made and, you know, who's making them. I know that, again, going back to the public records thing, like this is, I'm just obsessed with this lately, but there has been, you know, what appears to be, and this could be coincidence or not, but I mean, it looks like a pattern where a lot of these educational entities are not responding to public records very well. Coeur d'Alene Press just won a lawsuit to get some records, I think related to NIC.
Yeah, it was related.
There's been a lot of pushback by Ed News against U of I. They've been having just a ton of difficulty getting records out of U of I. You know, the West Bonner stuff we've already talked about. So whether that's related or not, I don't know. But there is, I think, a sense among people who cover education in the state that there's some disturbing trends occurring with the way that some of these districts and some of these institutions are being managed and the way that they're communicating, not only with the public, but with, you know, the press who, you know, we're supposed to be the conduit, you know, through which a lot of that information comes, and it's just not happening.
Yeah. Real quick before the show ends, I do want to mention some wider Idaho news. Idaho ended their 2023 fiscal year with a $99 million surplus, which will be swept into the property tax reduction package. In a similar vein to this, the state superintendent, Debbie Critchfield, is putting a K-12 funding formula rewrite on a fast track, trying to get that done in barely 6 weeks.
Which sounds impossible.
That well, is not
it's ambitious, for sure.
Reading from Idaho Ed News, on Wednesday morning, Critchfield packed a conference room with powerful groups of politicos and education groups, and her and the State Department senior team seeked a formula that is simpler, more responsive to local needs, and aligned with the state's constitution mandate through uniform system of public schools. She wants all this done by September 1st, which, yeah, like you guys mentioned, does not seem like a lot of time to get something like this done.
Well, I think, you know, it goes further in the article about that. I think it's been since 1996 that we've been using this this formula, this funding formula for public schools, K through 12. And I think there was a line here. We have a line from Dave Lent, who's from Idaho Falls, Republican from Idaho Falls. He said, we have a Model A system living in a Tesla world. And so, you know, I think here, and maybe Zach, you can speak to this a little bit, is that, you know, the growth that we've seen in Idaho since the 1990s is just, it's been amazing. But, you know, in a lot of cases, we have the stuff that was written, you know, or enacted when Idaho was a much smaller smaller in population. And so is this something that's pretty common that a lot of the forms of government are looking at how to fund things now that we've got all of this growth?
Yeah, I think sort of writ large, you talk about this budget surplus thing. And I think Governor Little, he is a politician. And so it always behooves politicians to try to reduce these complex government budgets down to the kitchen table. and try to tell people that it's just like budgeting in your home. Well, it isn't. It's billions of dollars. And Idaho is one of the states that receives more from the federal government than it pays in. I think it's like $1.69 or something. Every dollar 69, or every dollar we spend or send to the feds, we get $1.69 back. So the idea that we're like conservatively budgeting so well, and that's the reason why we have this big surplus, is a little bit disingenuous. I mean, we get a lot from the feds. We only spent a fraction of the coronavirus relief money we got. And it's true that a lot of the government agencies are cutting back on their spending to sort of prepare for handling the growth. So I think there is some conservative budgeting going on. But I wouldn't say that they're they're necessarily so far ahead of the ball on a lot of this stuff as they would like to make it look. I think withholding funding and underfunding certain things has also been a strategy to sort of bolster this surplus. And the property tax relief is a political gesture. I mean, it's very popular, and that's why they're doing it. I mean, they could be putting that money elsewhere, the education budget for one thing. But, it is what it is. It's budgets are always political, and I think that the growth has been a challenge in the state throughout, and I think that that conservative budgeting has been a response to it. But I also think sort of hoarding our money has been a response to it as well. Mm-hmm. So that's my two cents, so to speak.
We are out of time, so we thank you for joining us, and we hope you listen in next week. Goodbye.